Good day, everyone, and thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. To find out more about our upcoming shows or access to our more than 1,600 podcast episodes, visit our website at www.bitesradio.me. Today, my special guest is Stephen B. Post, PhD, author of Pure Unlimited Love, Science and the Seven Paths to Inner Peace. Pure Unlimited Love outlines a unique framework based on paths that can transform the mind, body, and spirit and spark worldwide cultural renewal in times of personal or communal chaos and uncertainty. Dr. Post is the director of Center for Medical Humanities, Compassionate Care, and Bioethics at the Renaissance School of Medicine at Stony Brook University. He founded the Institute for Research on Pure Unlimited Love with initial support from his mentor, Sir John Templeton. Dr. Post is author of several books, including Why Good Things Happen to Good People, How to Live Longer, Happier, and Healthier Life by the Simple Act of Caring, and has authored over 400 articles in peer-reviewed journals. For more information, you can visit his website, which is www.stephengpost.com, and it's Stephen with a P-H, so it's stephengpost.com. And with that, I'd like to welcome Stephen to the show. Good day, sir.
Well, it's a pleasure to be with you. Thanks for having me.
It is my pleasure. And anytime I can help listeners get more pure love in their life, then I'm doing a good job. And I'm looking forward to you talking about your work. So,
okay.
As this show is bringing inspiration to Earth, I usually like to start with, you know, what inspired you to write Pure Unlimited Love?
Well, life is difficult, and love makes it much less so. In fact, it makes it positive. Without love, we have nothing. And we live in a challenging period right now. People are forgetting how to love, how to laugh. They're forgetting how to nurture one another. And I think we need to take a careful look at that. And Pure Unlimited Love is an effort to help people bring closure to this very difficult period.
So how would you define pure unlimited love?
Well, okay, first off, how about love? How would I define love?
Yeah.
Well, not the love of chocolate or the love of designer jeans, although those are fine things and I have nothing against them. Something a little more profound. So love, as I define it, is the following. When the well-being and the security of another is as real or meaningful to you as your own, and sometimes even more so, you love that person. There's no fancy language, no Greek, no Latin, but it makes common sense. If you're meeting an old friend and the coffee shop who's had a hard time, if you're at work and someone's kind of stuck with their projects and not able to get very creative, love kind of works. It works when you're looking over the crib of a child or a grandchild, when you're just consoling a colleague. So that idea of love makes a lot of sense. It's not particularly majestic, but it's commonsensical. And it's very user-friendly. So then what is pure unlimited love? That's your next question, right?
That's correct.
Okay. So pure unlimited love is not human love. Pure unlimited love is love of the divine. I have a friend here who chairs family medicine. His name is Jeff Trilling. And I asked Jeff, what do you think pure unlimited love is? And he paused. He said very slowly, pure unlimited love is the first thing you see when you close your eyes for the last time, comma, hopefully. In other words, it has a metaphysical element to it, and people talk about remembered experiences of death. They talk about mystical moments when this kind of breaks into their consciousness. The bottom line is that that metaphysical side of love is very, very important. But the everyday practical sense of unlimited love is very important as well. So the question there is, how does that get expressed in ways that can be useful and practical? And that's what a lot of the book is about. So I talk about the wheel of love. Did you see that?
Yes. Excuse me, yes. Mm-hmm.
So I'm always asking myself, because I have a lot of responsibilities, a number of people I have to look after at work, in my family, in my neighborhood. I kind of know them fairly well. I know what's going on with their lives. So I have a sense of what form or expression of love they need. You can't just run around talking love, 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 because it's not quite down to earth. So it could be that someone needs love expressed as compassion. If they're struggling, if they're suffering with an illness, or if one of their loved ones has passed away, maybe they need love expressed as what I call carefrontation, which you may have heard from M. Scott Peck once upon a time, who wrote The Road Less Traveled. He was a great psychiatrist and a friend of mine. And he said, you need, Stephen, a form of love that isn't just soft and friendly, but is nevertheless able to stay connected with people and keep them on the right track. So carefrontation is his expression. And I know sometimes every day I come into this work at a big hospital, I know there are some people who need to be guided a little bit. They need carefrontation. They don't need tough love. They don't need confrontation, but they need carefrontation. And then some people need a little mirth and laughter. Because, you know, look at our society. A lot of times we seem to have forgotten how to laugh. And laugh is a very important expression of love. It, in a millisecond, helps people rethink, reorient themselves from a negative place to a positive place. It's very good biologically. It's good for your health. But it's also great for the people around you. So these are all different expressions of love. And I tend to prepare myself every morning. I meditate a bit on the people I know I'm going to see, and I ask myself, what form of love do they really need? And that helps me a lot, helps me not just get through the day, but to get through the day in a way that flourishes.
Yeah, it seems that, well, first of all, when it comes to being able to determine the type of love one requires at any particular moment, do we go through different forms of needing different forms of love, you know, depending on situations?
Yeah, well, it's all love. It's, you know, love is love, and there's only one love. But depending on the situation, I come into work, maybe somebody's son has relapsed into addiction. Maybe somebody has lost confidence in their creativity. Maybe they have made a medical error and they feel like they want to quit medicine. So they need to forgive themselves and they need to be forgiven. So forgiveness, carefrontation, all of these things are expressions of love, depending entirely on what people need. So that's the key thing. I don't just like to talk about love in the abstract or love as a metaphysical principle, although I think that's important. I like to think about love in terms of its practical, everyday usability as a leadership philosophy.
Well, okay, so how does one set up a framework for being able to implement, I guess, or to follow the, you know, pure unlimited love or that particular style of living?
Well, I get up early in the morning. You know, the ancient rabbis, the Kabbalistic rabbis, said that the early morning, just when you get out of bed, is a great time for prayer and meditation, because you don't have much of a sense of time. You don't have much of a sense of place. You're kind of going to reorient yourself to time and place. But that's exactly where you want to be, to connect with the divine. They said that God is beyond time and place. And so if you can do that early morning practice, it can set up your day in a very positive direction. You can feel closer to God. You can feel inspired. You have to have a spiritual practice, because the culture that we live in is really quite spiritually destructive. You just look at the amount of rumination, of hate, of bitterness, of hostility, of violence, of polarization. And it's something that I did not experience when I was a kid growing up in America. My parents would disagree politically. One was a Democrat, another was a Republican, but we never got angry at one another. They never got up and left the table or threatened divorce. It was okay to have different opinions on things, and we need to get back to that. So for me, the best way to stay centered on love over the course of the day is in the early morning to meditate. And the great Kabbalistic Jewish rabbis always said that you want to do that early in the morning, as you just have gotten out of bed and you don't have much of a sense of time, you don't have much of a sense of place. And that's the nature of the divine, that it's also beyond time and place. And so that's the best time of the day, early on, to connect and feel that divine presence in your life, in your heart, and in your mind. So that's what I do, and I meditate on all the people that I know I'm going to see over the course of the day, because I have lots of leadership responsibility. I run a center and a division in a medical school, and I know basically where people are struggling, what their difficulties are, what they need from me. Somebody might need forgiveness. Somebody might need special listening. They might need a lot of different things, and I always want to be able to meet them where they are with the form of love that will lift them up in the most clear and beneficial fashion. So that's what I do. I have to set my day up early, and it doesn't mean I'm perfect. I'm not perfect. I can still get upset when someone stops needlessly at a yellow light and keeps me from making that left turn so I can get into work in a timely way. And I'm capable of falling full-chested on my horn, not yelling out an expletive, but just being upset. You know, you've got those moments in your daily life. But the way to control it all is to really center on meditation, mindfulness, and prayer early on, and then come back to that. I usually come back to that about the middle of the day. I have a little hourglass called Just a Minute. It's a miniature hourglass. It lasts literally a minute, and I just meditate on that. I just watch the sand go through that tube, and I think to myself, have I so far this day lived up to unlimited love? And I will generally be pretty clear on where I need to keep working on that day. And then at night, when I get home, I'll do the same thing. I'll ask myself questions about, how did I do as a loving, caring human being today? So that's what it is for me. It's about an internal practice, because the pressures from the outer world are so negative and so destructive, and even I would say so crazy and violent right now, that you need to protect yourself. And that means you have to look inside your spirit at what I call the one mind.
You know, it can be. I mean, first of all, I have to commend you stopping before the expletive. I find myself, unfortunately, not able to stop sometimes. But, you know, it seems that the focus on love and, you know, the idea of pure unlimited love, having that as a focus throughout the day reinforces not only the desire, but actual progress displayed each moment.
Yeah, I'm not a huge believer in mere human love. I'm a real believer in divine love. And in the book, you'll notice lots of passages from great artists, great mathematicians, great musicians, great poets who have had experiences that they describe eloquently of something invading their consciousness. So here's a little story for you. When I was a 17-year-old boy, I went out to Reed College in Portland, Oregon, and I was in the coffee shop in late January. It was raining out. It doesn't snow in Oregon. And some fellow came bounding through the door. His name was Andy, and he had a black motorcycle jacket on. He looked a little bit overwhelmed with, or inebriated, let me say that. And he asked, does anyone want to go for a ride on my brand new Harley Davidson? And I, like a fool, said yes. And I went out into the parking lot, jumped on that motorcycle behind him, and he took off. He hit 180 miles an hour in his Harley Davidson shovelhead and went through every red light, every stop sign. And then he went south on the Pacific Coast Highway. And he was just screaming into the night as that cold rain was pelting his cheeks. And I was crying because I honestly thought I was dead. I didn't think I would survive this. And lo and behold, after an hour or so, he did a wonderful Evel Knievel sort of U-turn over the Midway. And he went back to Oregon, to Portland, and he dropped me off exactly where he picked me up in front of the coffee house. And I stumbled across the bridge to my dormitory. And just as I crossed into the dormitory, the phone rang. Now notice, it's at that point, it is 11 o'clock Pacific time, and it's 2 o'clock East Coast time. And it was my mother. The phone rang. I never picked up the phone, but for some reason I felt nudged, literally nudged from behind to pick it up. I picked it up. I said, hello. And it was my mother. And she was there. She said, Stevie, you're alive. I thought you'd been killed. And she said, I woke up in my sleep and I was sweating and nervous. And I just knew something was really wrong. And I said, Mom, you know what? You were absolutely right. I thought I was gone. And we talked about my experience on Andy's motorcycle. And we started talking about the nature of the divine. And we both agreed that it's amazing that a mother who's 3,000 miles away, separated by various mountain ranges, that she could intuit, she could have a premonition about her son being so totally imperiled and so totally fearful. And so we agreed at that time that there is something about mind that is very mysterious. And all of my life, I've felt that mind is not just derived from brain, from tissue, from cells, but mind is unique. It is perhaps even the source of matter, mind before matter, the spiritual traditions say. So for me, that's the reality. And I have lived that life very well over the years. I was at the University of Chicago. I studied with the great Nobel laureate, Sir John Eccles, who won the prize for his study of the translation, the communication between neurons. Mm-hmm. And he always told me, he said, don't ever believe that brain is the source of mind, or that mind is nothing but brain. Mind is separate, and you cannot get mind out of brain any more than you can get blood out of a stone. The brain may be the platform for mind, but mind is something infinite. Mind comes from the divine. The Hindus say that the nature of the supreme being is supreme mind. God is that supreme mind and is characterized by love, creativity, and freedom. So if you live a life of love, creativity, and freedom, you are living a life that you were intended to live by the maker of this whole universe. And that's how I think of these things and have for many, many years. And it's worked for me. It's worked very well.
Yeah. Now, in the introduction, I mentioned seven paths that are included in, excuse me, pure unlimited love. So can you tell us, is this like a person would travel one of those paths, or are all of the paths part of our own unique path?
Well, that's a good question. I think most people travel all of those paths, or can travel all of those paths. The first one is, may you give and glow. Now, that means that when we give with kindness, we feel elated. We are freed from rumination, from negative emotions. This is all proved neurologically, and we are able to connect meaningfully with other human beings and experience what some people have referred to as a helper's high. Again, you don't have to be giving kindly all the time. It turns out just a few hours a week is plenty. It causes a certain kind of a shift from negative to positive affect and emotion. So I believe that may you give and glow is the beginning place for inner peace. And I think when we give and glow, we do feel sometimes beautifully overwhelmed by a peace that seems not to come from ourselves, but even from beyond ourselves. And St. Paul said that God loves a cheerful giver. And then the next path, may you heal with kindness. Well, I work in medical centers and have for 40 years, but I got to tell you, this is not just about people with nursing degrees or medical degrees. May you heal with kindness is for you, it's for me, it's for everybody, because you want to reach out into the world with a kind heart, and then you can heal everybody you encounter in your own right and in your own way. So heal with kindness. And then the third way, the third path, is may you follow your callings. Follow your callings. You know, everybody has a certain set of gifts and talents, and they need to cultivate those and apply them to the benefit of an identifiable constituency. If you're a teacher, so teach those students with love and kindness. If you're a physician, do the same for your patients. Whatever you do, do it with kindness and do it as a calling, because we all have these callings. And any teacher who tells a student that they don't have these special talents and gifts doesn't deserve to be a teacher, because the whole point of teaching is not to help people just fit in, but to actually discover their callings, to really discover what they are destined to become. And you can do that. We talk a lot about that in the book. And then the fourth area is, may you, this is interesting, may you raise kind children.
Mm-hmm.
Now, look, why bring children into the world if you don't want them to be kind? Anything else would be frustrating. I like to say kindness before careers. Career is important, but kindness is more important, and you will be more successful in your career to the extent that you're kind to those who are around you. So that's important. And then you have to stick with your callings. So that means sometimes you'll be pulled off course, a little more money, a little more prestige to do something different. But you need to stick with what you're called to do, because that way you can give and glow your whole life long. And that's a beautiful thing. And then sixthly, you want to cherish the gift of nature. These days, too many kids are just completely hooked up on the internet, on AI, and they're not really connecting with one another or with nature, with the natural world. So we need to do a lot more with our young people to connect them with nature, young and old, because without that connection, we cannot do well. And then finally, the seventh path, may you honor the spirit of freedom. And if you look at every spiritual tradition, they talk about freedom in a very deep way, not simply like a dog chewing through a leash, but they talk about freedom in terms of a spiritual quality that we are given by the divine. We are free in spirit. And if we can abide by that freedom, we can live prosperous and happy lives. So I'm a big believer in freedom. I'm a big believer in creativity and love and all the things we're talking about here. And I'm happy in life, and that's the way I want to live my life to the last of my breath.
I want to kind of just go a little bit deeper with a couple of questions I had about a couple of them. The first one would be follow your callings. Now, some people, you know, you mentioned that we all have a calling, whether or not we are in touch with it. Many people, I believe, would say that they don't even know what their calling is. I mean, maybe not a whole lot, but I mean, there are a good number of people who may not have really paid attention to something that may even resemble a calling, you know, rather than maybe mechanically, you know, going to and from work and spending a typical night, you know. So the idea of a calling may be kind of the farthest thing from their mind or even their imagination. What would you say to someone who has that feeling like, you know, there's no way I have a calling? How would I even begin to know what my calling would be?
So my answer is that everyone, without exception, has a set of gifts and talents that are natural to them. Every human being is a miracle of creation. Every single human being is a wonder of creation, and they have to wake up to that. Now, how do you do that? Well, I write a lot about volunteering, especially for adolescents. When adolescents volunteer, they get involved in helping activities. They may well find themselves. I did that when I was 14 or 15 years old, and I discovered my calling as a teacher, and I've been a successful university professor all these years. So I had to discover it. I had to experiment. But you know when you found it, because the line between work and play disappears.
Mm.
Your work becomes much more playful than you might ever have imagined. And you can come into work every day and feel buoyant and effervescent and happy with what you're doing. So callings are like that. Now, it's true that sometimes we have to take jobs just because we need to pay the bills. We have to get practical things taken care of. But hopefully, ideally, if you run into the right mentors, the right people in your life, you can find your calling, and you will have a much happier work life that way.
Yeah, I can understand that. And, you know, I think for, you know, some people, you know, the idea is to even begin to pay attention to, you know, those things that, you know, bring them joy, or that kind of activities they do in which they lose time, you know, or they're so involved or, you know, devoid of what's going on around them that all of a sudden it's like, oh my goodness, 3 hours have already passed.
That's having a calling. So I talk in my book about people like the poet W.H. Auden, who was just out on the lawn with some friends at a prep school north of Oxford in the U.K., and he felt invaded by this energy that was not his own energy, but that came from this universal source. And he knew that he could love individuals in a way that he never had before, that they were each of infinite value. And he had his calling at that point. Now, you know, he spent most of his life around Oxford, and he had followers, and he was always inspired to be with them and to help them through things in life. And he was really, truly a great poet. So he had his calling. Many, you know, there's a wonderful movie called The Man Who Knew Infinity about an Indian mathematician named Ramanujan from southern India. And he was not trained in mathematics, but when he would be praying at the foot of his goddess, his Hindu goddess, he would feel inspired, and he would receive these mathematical formulas, and he would write them down with his finger in the dirt. And then he'd come back a little later and he'd write them down in a notebook. So some great mathematician at Cambridge, G.H. Hardy, found out about Ramanujan, got a page from his notebook, and realized that this guy was a genius. So he brought him to Cambridge, and Ramanujan spent several years there. And his mathematics is pretty much the foundation of what we now call quantum mechanics. He didn't think he had to prove anything because he just knew it was right. He was called to mathematics. It's a beautiful, beautiful story. And nobody doubted that he was working in a way that was beyond his own capacities. So he had his calling. His calling came from the one mind that is beyond all minds. And it's, again, I don't believe that our minds are simply derived from our brains, from tissue, from material. I think that we all have the gift of the divine mind within us. And that's why these experiences really do happen to people. And they've happened to me, and they've happened to a lot of people.
Yeah. The idea of the divine, the inspiration that the divine mind can express, I guess, you know, that mm-hmm. is a one, when one experiences that, you know that it was that connection. And if you're like me, you always want to try and recreate or, you know, re-envision or re-experience that kind of inspiration.
Oh, absolutely. And whether you need it more than once in life, you know, Mother Teresa had it when she was a young girl, and it kept her active in Calcutta. She lost it a little bit, as she wrote, in older age, but then she got it back. And so you don't need this repeatedly, but you need to experience something, hopefully. So I like this passage from my favorite poet, as I mentioned, W.H. Auden. And here's what he said, single paragraph. Just listen to this. One fine night in June 1933, I was sitting on a lawn after dinner with three colleagues, two women and one man. We liked each other well enough, but were certainly not intimate friends, nor had any one of us a sexual interest in another. Incidentally, we had not drunk any alcohol. We were talking casually about everyday matters when, quite suddenly and unexpectedly, something happened. I felt myself invaded by a power, which though I consented to it, was irresistible and certainly not mine. For the first time in my life, I knew exactly what it means to love one's neighbor as oneself. My personal feelings toward my colleagues were unchanged. They were still colleagues, not intimate friends, but I felt their existence as themselves to be of infinite value and rejoiced in it. So he had a calling, and you know, he was not, he was a member of the Church of England after that point, but before then he had no particular religiosity at all. So somehow or another he was awakened into a very different kind of life, and he lived a very beautiful life. So I think you can get callings in different ways. Sometimes it can be very spiritual, and sometimes it can just be a kind of self-realization of what your great talents are. You know, I'm an Ohioan, and Thomas Alva Edison, by the way, was not born in New Jersey. He was born in Milan, Ohio, and his parents had a farm. And he was a young kid. He was only 11 or 12 years old, and he was thrown out of his local grade school because people thought his mind didn't work right. Maybe he was a little bit of a high-functioning person on the autism spectrum. Who knows? But they threw him out of school, and he went home, and his loving mother said to him, Thomas, don't give up. Go into the barn and start tinkering, create things, make things. You can be a light to the world, she said. And, of course, he was, because he invented the light bulb. And that was through his mother's love, his mother refusing to forget that this young kid had great gifts and a natural talent and a calling. And of course, the rest is history. So I think that we can sometimes experience that divine elevation directly through a kind of a mystical experience, like W.H. Auden had, and sometimes through others, in the case of Edison, through his mother. And that's just as good. So I really truly believe that nobody is without a calling. And if they feel that they don't have a calling, they need to experiment a little bit, take a few chances. It doesn't mean quit your job, but it means do some things that can bring out your optimal creativity.
I understand the joy of creativity for me. One area that I put a lot of attention to, and it seems that, you know, if one is trying to discover their calling, it will usually require just a reapportionment of time. You know, like you said, you know, mm-hmm. go out and, you know, tinker and experiment. So it seems that, you know, maybe a little less TV, a little less social media, and a little bit more tinkering would help maybe add clarity.
Yes, very much so. And by the way, I might make a comment on the social media thing. It does a lot of good in the world, but it's also very damaging. I mean, there's mm-hmm. lots of studies now that a generation of young people don't have the kinds of social skills that they would have had otherwise. And there's even something, you can Google it, called AI psychosis, mm-hmm. which psychiatrists are talking about now, where some individuals, some younger people, have gotten so locked into AI, they ask the AI source, can you help me? I'm struggling with this. And the AI, which is just a machine, it's nothing more than a machine, it has no warmth, no love, no heart, it might say with the right tone, well, maybe I can help you. Why don't you try this? And that can be okay to some small degree, but then there are still about 17 teenage suicides attributed directly to AI, and these are not people who had histories of depression, but rather they were on AI, and the AI kind of walked them down this garden path to self-destruction. So AI is not everything it's cracked up to be.
No. That is,
it doesn't have heart, doesn't have love, doesn't have heart.
Right, yes. And it is alarming, the, you know, teenage suicide, AI-driven teenage suicide. To me, it's just a testament to how so many children or adolescents even in this particular time prefer to interact with machines versus a human being.
Absolutely. And, you know, I was at a restaurant in New York a couple of years ago, more than a couple of years ago, probably 10 years ago, with an old friend from high school. And we looked at the table next to us, and there were three generations there. There were the little kids, two of them, and they had their iPads in front of them, and then there were their parents and their grandparents. And during that whole hour, the kids never looked up at their grandparents. So there was none of that intergenerational flow or of wisdom from one generation to the next. That was out of the picture. And my friend leaned over to me and he said, is this the end of civilization? And I said, it could be. Because if you don't have that kind of transposition, that kind of movement of wisdom, of kindness, of role modeling, of all of the kinds of things that make for a good life, if you don't have that being transmitted from one generation to the next, you're really out of business. And, you know, Hannah Arendt, the great professor of sociology at the University of Chicago, said, when empathy dies, civilization dies.
Yeah.
And I think that's true.
Yeah. And it's sad to see the state we're in right now, because I don't see a whole lot of empathy, or not as much as one would hope, or even in the time period where we grew up in.
I think that's true. And so I try to teach that to people through various interesting, innovative methodologies wherever I am, in schools, medical schools, and so forth. And you get pretty good at it, and we're pretty successful. But it's not an easy thing to do, and it's not didactic. It's not just a matter of downloading facts from a PowerPoint. You have to actually have activities. You have to have role-playing. It can involve mindfulness and meditation. And it's a beautiful thing. You can teach these assets, but people get started at a big disadvantage when they don't have it in their homes, when mm-hmm. they're not interacting at the right levels with the people around them.
I agree. And we're just about out of time, but there's one I want to touch on a little bit deeper because it's kind of near and dear to me, and it was the may you cherish the gift of nature.
Yes.
Prior to today's, I'm a nature photographer, so prior to today's show, it was in the upper 30s here in South Carolina. But
cold.
Yeah, very cold. But I went to a local garden that I go to once a week just for my little photography session, grounding, and whatever I can get with being with nature. And a couple of people said that I was kind of nuts going out in the cold, but you know, it was, yes, it was nippy, but it was one of those crisp kind of days that nature still provided.
So, you know, if you go to, I went to an Episcopal church in Cleveland for many years, and there was a wonderful naturalistic center in the middle of the building that had a statue of St. Francis, that had wind chimes, that had a flowing brook, and beautiful plants all around. And it was a wonderful place to pray and to come back into contact with one's inner being. That's so important. And, you know, when you are driving through the hillsides and you look at the fall leaves, there's something so spiritual about this. And there are very few people who have been deeply spiritual who have not been also naturalistic. So Jesus would go out into the hillside to be in nature when he wanted to get close to God. And I think that's something to really recognize. So I refer to nature as a divine gift. Not that we should worship nature. I don't believe in that. But nature is a divine gift. It's something that we are given in all its majesty and beauty. We experience awe, wonder, the amazing depths of the natural world. And that contributes to our ability to get free from a lot of the negative things in our environment and to really come closer to the divine presence through meditation and prayer.
Yeah, definitely not worship, but certainly appreciated and to express gratitude for the ability to even experience it.
Yeah, gratitude is really important, and gratitude is on my wheel of love. It's one of the expressions of love. If you love someone, you want to be grateful for the achievements, for the things that they've done. That is very important. So gratitude matters a lot. In some ways, gratitude is even more, even comes before love, because gratitude opens us up to an emotional space where we get freed to be more loving. So I'm a big fan of gratitude, and the gratitude for nature is so important, and we need to emphasize that with our kids and with ourselves.
I agree. So the last question is, what do you hope readers will take away from reading Pure Unlimited Love?
Well, I think they should take away the idea that without love, we are out of business as a civilization, even as a species. And by the way, this kind of generous love is very much, it is evolved and part of our hard wiring, because even Darwin, at the end of his life in The Descent of Man, said that a lot of evolution doesn't occur between individuals. competing for some commonly desired object in the environment, me versus you, but it occurs between groups. So group one is going to prosper to the extent that its members evolve empathy, compassion, kindness within it. And that is so true, whether you think about businesses or schools, to the extent that that is a presence in the culture and in people's lives and hearts, they will have a successful social world. So it's incredibly vital. Love, we need to get back to love. We need to realize that it's not such a weird thing when you start to think about how it's expressed. I mean, anytime I'm in this building and I'm kind to somebody, I'm mirthful, I give them a tasteful, uplifting bit of humor that will free them up from some of their worries and preoccupations. Anytime I just take a few minutes to listen to people who have not been listened to, or to give a word of compassion to a patient who's really suffered a lot, anytime I do that, that's all love. And that's what we need to recognize. Love is not strange, weird, esoteric. It's quite practical. And you can make love your philosophy of life, your leadership, and it will do you wonders. It's as good for you as it is for anybody else.
I agree. Well, Stephen, thank you for your time today. I've enjoyed our conversation, and I want to let everybody know today my special guest has been Stephen G. Porter. Stephen G. Post, author of Pure Unlimited Love, Science, and the Seven Paths to Inner Peace. And you can find out more by visiting Stephen's website, which is www.stephengpost.com, and that's Stephen with a PH, stephengpost.com. Well, again, thank you for your time again, Dr. Post. I really appreciate it.
Well, it's a pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
You're very welcome. And in closing, everyone, I want to thank you for listening to this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. And remember to be a bright light by bringing inspiration to your world and to the lives of those you touch.